Welcome to another edition of Sci-Fi on Screen. My name is Jeff Palermo, and this is Episode 3, The Matrix Revolutions. The Matrix Revolutions was released in November of 2003, several months after Reloaded was released. So Reloaded came out in the summer, and Revolutions was released in November. Let's jump right in. As in The Matrix and The Matrix Revolutions, we start out with the green characters scrolling down the screen, which again leads us to a terrific continuity. You know, there is continuity in the credits, very Star Warsian of them to do that, but it makes for a comfortable experience for the viewer. This time, we travel through the characters, and we are now on the Hammer, a hovercraft, and Morpheus is on the Hammer with the Hammer's crew, and we see that everyone is searching for Niobe and the Logos. Now, brief recap at the end of The Matrix Revolutions, the Hammer picked up Trinity, Morpheus, Link, and Neo after the Nebuchadnezzar was blown apart, and Neo destroyed the Sentinels and passed out. So now the two crews are together on the Hammer, captained by a gentleman named Roland. And they're doing a search for Niobe and the Logos, which was the other ship that was sent out to find Neo. They cannot find Niobe in the Matrix, and they can't seem to locate the Logos anywhere nearby. So they start a search. We now cut to the med bay. Trinity is watching over Neo, who is what looks like a coma, where there's a discussion of also of Bane. And Bane is also in a coma. And again, we recap that Bane is the sole survivor of sort of the counterattack debacle, where the group of hovercrafts tried to intercept the machines, trigger their EMPs, and stop the attack. Someone triggered an EMP early and foiled the whole thing. And Bane's the only survivor, and until he wakes up, no one's going to really know what happened. And this time, it's a quiet beginning. The beginnings of The Matrix and the beginnings of The Matrix Reloaded are very action-oriented. It's a nice change to start quiet. Coming from a lot of the bombast of Reloaded, I think it's a really solid beginning. A bit of information is given. The woman in the med bay tells Trinity that Neo seems fine, except his neural patterns are strange, and we find out that his neural patterns are that of someone who's jacked into the Matrix, and of course Neo is not jacked in, so a small mystery is begun. Then two pieces of information arrive in the ship. The first, that the machines are going to be in Zion in 20 hours, their digging schedule, and at the same time they get a call from Seraph, and the Oracle wants to talk to Morpheus and Trinity right away. So the plot is spiked, as it were. Now we cut to Neo, who is waking up in a train tunnel. A small child walks up to him, and they have this discussion. We understand that the train station is kind of a way station between the machine world and the Matrix. Programs are smuggled in between from one to the other. And we're told that someone named the Train Man is not going to let Neo go with these other programs who are there, and that he's not a very nice guy. We cut away, and now we're back in the public housing block of the first Matrix. The Oracle's sort of back in her old haunts again. The first thing we see is that she is not Gloria Foster. She's played by a woman, I believe, by the name of Mary Alice. And straight away, unfortunately, she doesn't have the dash of Gloria Foster. And it's possible that this was done intentionally as you come to understand what happened to her. But Mary Alice's delivery is very flat. I don't get the sense that she's really imbuing her lines with any kind of real substance. She's just kind of mouthing them. Maybe it was a fact of they had to get her at the last minute. Who knows? But she ain't Gloria Foster, that's for sure. They make the best of a bad situation, and they, I mean the Wachowskis. The story is that the Oracle made a choice, and it cost her more than she wanted it to. We get the notion that, you know, she had a bit of bad business happen to her, and whatever the choice she made, whatever happened to her, changed her digital avatar into this new form. Look, we all know that Gloria Foster died, so we go with the Wachowskis on this, right? What are you going to do? As filmmakers, you make the best of it. So now the Oracle tells Trinity and Morpheus pretty much the same story that we heard from the little girl, that he's being held by this program called the Train Man, who works for the Merovingian. And we're confirmed that place that Neo is in actually is between the machine world and the Matrix, and it's used to smuggle programs back and forth. At the end of this conversation, we find out that the Merovingian has placed a price on Morpheus, Neo, and Trinity's head, and that it's not going to be as easy to get what they need from him as the last time. She also sends Seraph with them to help. And of course, for story logic, we need to have a discussion between the Oracle and Morpheus, because now Morpheus realizes that the whole prophecy was bunk. So he confronts the Oracle about how hollow things were. And there's no apology in the Oracle. It's like, you're going to make your own damn mind, and I'm going to tell you what I've always told you, what you need to hear. And at this point in the movie, it's a little convoluted, and to me, it comes across as a little bit of a patch, as it were, as if they didn't have this thing really figured out from the beginning. But maybe they did, and maybe it's me. For me, it comes across a little hollow in the film. Back to Neo in the train station. He's speaking with a man and a woman and a child, and basically they paid the Merovingian to smuggle their daughter, who is all a small program, out of the machine mainframe. And we discovered that these three characters are all programs in the machine world. They've created their daughter. You come to understand that their daughter is a program that these two programs have created, but lacks a purpose in the machine world, and so, of course, would be targeted for deletion, which is why they're trying to smuggle it out via the train man and the Merovingian. And a bit of Easter egg-y trivia. In Reloaded, when they first come to see the Merovingian, you do see the man, the father, in the nightclub just leaving. So it's a nice little bit of continuity for the conscientious viewer. So then we get our first philosophical discussion of the third film, and the topic this time is love. The programs tell Neo that, you know, they're trying to smuggle their daughter out because they love her, and Neo says, well, you're programs, what do you know of love? The programs say love is a word, and it's simply there to describe the connection the word implies behind it, which is a terrific notion. What else is love, right? The word is meaningless, but it does imply a connotation behind it of intense connection. And nicely done. And again, the seeds are planted in this film, as in Reloaded, that the machines are not all evil, and that in fact, it looks like coexistence and peace is kind of the way to go. That a lot of the machines really don't have anything against human beings, and they would be happy to coexist. And in fact, as conscious beings, they do have feelings of a similar nature, germane to their specific race. So a really nice way to define love and to sort of point this trilogy towards conclusion. We now cut back to Morpheus and Trinity walking through a moving subway car, and they confront the train man, who, Road Warrior fans unite, is none other than Bruce Spence. So the train man sees them, stops the train, and they give a brief chase around the subway train, but of course the train man's in control of things, and he completely eludes them. We then briefly cut back to a station where Neo is. The train arrives, and the family and child get on the train, and Neo tries to get on right with him, but Bruce Spence blocks him, and then finally understands who he is. Neo threatens him, and the train man basically says, you don't understand, this is my world, I created it, I'm God, and he punches Neo extremely hard, smashes him halfway through a wall, Neo collapses, the train man gets on his train, and everyone leaves. Neo then tries to run after them. He runs into one tunnel and then comes back behind himself in another tunnel. So there's basically no way out. And Neo is now trapped. So far in the film, things are just proceeding apace. The Oracle was a little bit of a letdown, but we're getting plot, we're getting action, things are moving. So far, so good. As a Matrix viewer, I'm pretty pleased with things. It's really well shot, and the train station looks amazing, and things are in good shape. Then we cut to Seraph, Trinity, and Morpheus as they confront three guards in the basement of the Merovingian's club. And this is a back-to-old-school first movie fight sequence. Everything is cut very concisely. The fighting is very controlled. We're seeing everything. And in short order, the three protagonists take down the three guards. And as soon as the fight ends, there's a really cool moment when Colin Chow, who plays Seraph, is a close-up upon him, and you hear some drumming. And the music to this, again, is back to the Japanese drumming, and it's fantastic. And the last scene is a brief drum flourish, and the breeze kind of ruffles Seraph's collar, and you cut away, and it's cool. It's like, damn, you know, that's, I think it's all the more cool because it's become increasingly less and less in the films that have grown in epic stature, that these little cool moments have gone by the wayside. So when they pop up again, it's really a treat. So the three of them head down to the coat check room, which is basically where all the weapons are kept. As soon as the doors to the elevator open, everyone realizes who they are, and this huge fight ensues. And the wrinkle to this fight is that the gravity in the room on the enemy side suddenly brings them up to the ceiling. So you have our heroes fighting on the floor and the enemies fighting on the ceiling. And it's a really neat twist, and and they edit it and shoot it really well. So it's actually a really cool fight. The bad guys are dressed kind of in domination gear. It's a little odd, but the gravity aspect of it is great, and it affords for some cool moments where Trinity's fighting someone who's standing on the ceiling and she's on the floor, and you know, her kick is aimed squarely at the guy's face because he's down that low. There's moments like that that are really good. And the columns in the place are made of some ablative soft stone, just very similar to the first Matrix when they entered into where the guards were holding Morpheus. And there's that amazing fight where the stone's flying so much it's almost like part of the atmosphere. Very similar here where, you know, a lot of the stone is chipping away and it's filling the air with a lot of dust. And it's a really cool fight. It's not cool in the sense of, you know, you're seeing things land, but it's a cool fight in terms of the spectacle of it. And it's over fairly quickly, so it doesn't go on for too long. It's neat having the gravity effect. So the next cut is them going up a level and going into the nightclub. And the three of them move through the nightclub back to back to back. So the three of them are all back to back with their guns out. It's a pretty cool scene. There's some lasers above the crowd, which look like these green, you know, flickering blades above everything. Really cool shot. And they're moving through the floor. And, of course, the Merovingian tells them to halt, but he says that he will grant them safe passage if they simply drop their weapons. Our heroes lower their weapons and go up there now, basically prisoners of the Merovingian. So from the Merovingian, we understand what the Oracle had previously said about having made a choice, that she had some run-in with the Merovingian, and she was the worse off for it. So he must have damaged her in some way. We're not sure why or what, but it's another piece of the puzzle to the change in aspect of the Oracle. Then we move into a very unlikely and very deus ex machina to getting Neo back. The Merovingian says, I will be happy to give you Neo, but in return I want the eyes of the Oracle. Suddenly, one of our protagonists makes a move and there's some fighting. Gun is thrown up in the air and Trinity catches it and points it right at the Merovingian's head and basically says, give me Neo or I'll kill you. The fact that this works is patently absurd given the Merovingian's power and where he is and what they would have to do to get him. That's simply Trinity holding a gun to her head. And they up the ante by Persephone saying, she'll kill us all. Look at her face. She's in love. And we're supposed to believe that Trinity's become unhinged, that she would actually kill the Merovingian. there's no way she would do it. The whole thing just seems like a very quick and easy solution to how to get Neo back. And unfortunately, I don't buy it for a moment. So now, after a few sequences, Neo goes back to the Oracle, who is making cookies yet again with Sati. He again confronts her about some of the answers she has given him, and we get these elliptical phrases that satisfy no one about choice and about this and about that. But what we do get is she gives him the news that, you know, going forward, like, it's basically him versus Smith, and Smith will be able to move into his world, and Neo doesn't really understand the full ramifications of that yet. But the Oracle says that Smith just, he wants everything, and Neo's the only one who can stop him. And as a character, she ceases now to be of any use to us. And unlike what happens to Morpheus in this film, the Wachowskis say goodbye to her. Soon after Neo leaves, the Oracle sends Sati away with Seraph. As they're leaving, they realize Smith has entered the building. It's converging on them. And of course, the Smiths surround them in a dark room and absorb both Sati and Seraph. Now we cut back to the Oracle, who's sitting in her room smoking a cigarette, and in comes the Smiths. Ha ha. Great scene between the Oracle and Smith, where Smith's like, he smashes something against the wall and says, did you think I was going to do that? Maybe you didn't. Maybe you did. Actually, Hugo Weaving is kind of the best thing about this movie because, boy, does it need an influx of some life and some comedy. It's all very dour and flat. And the Oracle asks Smith what he did to Sati, and he's like, cookies need love like everything does. She's like, you bastard. But Smith rules, and then he finally gets to the Oracle, and he absorbs her, and yet another Smith is made. And we say goodbye to the Oracle. This is going to take me into talking about what happens to Morpheus in this movie, because part of writing, I think part of storytelling, is that when a character has served its purpose and no longer needs to be in the film or in the story, the character needs to exit the story in one way or another. Either the character goes off into another place or another world or dies. And Morpheus is dead weight in this movie. He has no purpose whatsoever. I'll continue on with that later. It's a little early for me to be doing this piece, but what works is them killing the Oracle, because the Oracle is someone you have sympathy for. For better or for worse, she's been trying to help our hero throughout all these films. And now Smith has killed her, and it gives the movie a little grit. Someone has died. From what we can tell looking at this movie right now, she's dead. It gives the movie some weight. It gives the movie consequences. Characters do die. And it takes us away from kind of the hokum of Reloaded, which is, you know, everyone wins all the time and, you know, there are no real consequences. More to say about Morpheus as we go forward. So now we've got some setup plot that has to take place before the big battle. You have Bane waking up and can't remember anything. We have the return of Niobe and the finding of the Logos. We have Locke in front of the council. They're asking about the ships. Locke is saying he hasn't heard from anyone. We have the scene of Z, so that's Link's girlfriend, making shells, and her sister, I believe, or her friend, is leaving for shelter, and they have this conversation, you know, if you knew if Dozer was out there and the only hope for him coming back was to hold the dock, what would you do? And she'd make shells. It's a really good scene, actually. I don't want to say nice scene. It's a good scene. And we find out that Z has joined the infantry, and now we also see Mifune and Neo's worshiper, the Kid, and it turns out that the mechs, this is something that I really enjoy about this film and this part of it, is that the mechs need to be reloaded. We don't have this sci-fi trope of like every gun shoots forever. The exoskeletons that the soldiers use run out of bullets. And you have these characters, these younger characters who are behind in a protected area with carts full of ammo waiting to be called. And when they're called, they got to run out in the middle of the battle, load these mechs in the middle of like Sentinel shooting and firing. It grounds what could be otherwise a too Star Warsy a scene in some reality. And I think it's a great idea. Part of this reloading plot development is supposedly attributed to a film done in the 30s, All Quiet on the Western Front, which I have not seen, so I can't verify that, but I heard some scuttlebutt, some of the things that I've read, that the reloading sequence was kind of taken from that film, and sounds cool to good to me, man. It's like a classic film. So now we're back with the hammer and the Logos figuring out what's next, and they're talking about getting back to Zion to deal with the machine invasion. Now they have the two ships. They're trying to figure out where to go. Captain of the Hammer is pointing out some one area. Niobe is saying, well, we can get, you know, this is a better way. We could go through what they call a mechanical line. And the Captain of the Hammer, Roland, says, nobody can pilot a mechanical. And Niobe says, oh, I can. And he says, well, what's the point? You know, there's two of us, so you can do it. What are we supposed to do? And in that moment, Neo barges in and says, I know what I have to do. I need one of the ships to go to the Machine City. Roland from the Hammer is like, you're out of your mind. Niobe gives him her ship. You get a sense that she's really kind of coming in line with Morpheus and Neo, and that she believes in him. It's a great line where Morpheus says, I thought you didn't believe in the legend of the One. She says, I don't. I believe in him. But again, you know, before Neo came in, it was Niobe and Roland who were center stage deciding on strategy. Morpheus just sort of in the back, hanging out. You know, he has no role in almost anything else to come. They're getting ready to go. Neo knows he has to go to the city, but he tells Trinity he doesn't think he's coming back. Trinity knows it. She's going anyway. There's a nice little scene between them. It's kind of a goofy line or two, but it's a nice scene, and you know that she's going to be along for the ride. What's nice about it is that, you know, there's a notion here of love being about sacrifice rather than everybody gets everything they want, that she's willing to sacrifice herself for Neo because she loves him. And Hollywood-esque as it may be, it's still a really solid notion. Now, another big problem here, right here happens is that there's a goodbye scene between Morpheus and Neo, and, you know, you basically get it was an honor, sir, and the honor was mine, and that's it. Trinity serves with Morpheus for decades. There's no goodbye scene for Trinity. And this is more of a problem what happens to Trinity in this scene. She becomes like Neo's most fanatical supporter. Obviously, she loves him, but there is no one else but Trinity. Like, if someone tries to talk to Trinity, like, she seems annoyed. You know, she's just like completely and utterly devoted to Neo in mind and body, and has no room for anyone else. You know, and in this film, in this role, there is no other thing for her. She is Neo's lover and protector, and that's it. And I feel like it's a discredit to her as a character. You know, she was a great character in this film. She goes out in a spectacular way, but, I mean, my God, how could there not be history between her and Morpheus? And there's nothing. She's standing in the elevator waiting for Neo impatiently while he says goodbye to Morpheus. So there was something emotionally wrong with that beat of the film. And then the hammer leaves. We find out from a point of view on the hammer that Bane had woken up and killed a woman in the medbay, but now is gone. So we realize that he's on the Logos. So there's a bit of a hostage standoff where Bane slash Smith has Trinity hostage and tells Neo to sort of drop his weapon. Then Trinity drops down a hatch and you have a fight between Bane and Neo. At one point, Bane is being choked and he grabs a live electrical wire and sticks it in Neo's eyes and blinds him. And there's a moment where Trinity actually turns off the power to the ship. Bane and Neo are fighting in the dark, and it's a cool effect, a cool shot. And one of the cool things that happens, because Neo gets blinded, Bane's waiting for him in the dark, Neo's blind. We see from Neo's point of view that he can actually see Bane slash Smith. He can see the Smith in Bane, let's put it that way. What he can seemingly see is machine entities. So that when Smith slash Bane takes a whack at him, Neo's there, he takes control of the situation and winds up killing Bane. And there's this great scene when he finally says, "I can see you." And there's an Agent Smith who basically is made out of fire with his glasses on still, so you kind of know it's him. But it's a cool scene. It's a notion that's going to continue on in Neo's story that I feel is a really neat choice. When Neo wins the fight in the real world, he takes a crowbar to Bane's head. But as he's viewing the situation, Smith inside of Bane actually disintegrates, as in like a shower of sparks. Again, a terrific choice, terrific visual sequence. So now we're getting, the Sentinels are close and Zion is preparing for battle. We're deploying what they call the APUs, which I believe is Armored Personnel Units, and their ammo loaders. And they look really cool. This is big epic sci-fi city. And there's a scene where most of the APUs are sort of in a crouch mode. And Mifune, as the first one, powers his unit up and stands up. And all of the units behind him follow suit. But as they're doing it, the camera is streaming backwards over them. And it looks like a wave of these metal constructs just kind of slowly rippling forward. It's a terrific scene. And it's a great prelude to the battle. There's the perfunctory general before the battle speech. Thank God it's really, really short, so we don't care. And then we get to see that Z and someone named Chara are part of these two-man, basically RPG teams that are going up above the city to try to take out the big digging machines before they break through. So you're going to have now two different parts of battle to cut back and forth from. You're going to have the hammer trying to get back. You're going to have the main battle on the dock, and you're going to have the two-man teams. It's classic Lucas-esque endgame, three sequences going at the same time so you can flip back and forth. So now back on the hammer, the reduction of Morpheus to basically ballast. Niobe's the only one who can pilot the ship. She is in complete command. Roland, who's the captain of the ship, takes command of the rest of the folks, and they go sit behind these guns, which is right out of Millennium Falcon, Star Wars, as the Sentinels have heard them. And as Niobe's piloting them along the mechanical line, the Sentinels are giving chase. Roland and his crew are fighting them off with the guns. And where's Morpheus? He's a navigator. He's sitting there in the navigation seat, completely defanged and powerless as ballast. So the opening of the battle on the dock is really, really cool. Again, the dock is, because it's a dome, it makes it look like a huge temple. And you see this huge digging machine breach the top of the dock, and immediately swarms of sentinels come through this tunnel. And every APU unit sort of raises up their guns, and all the fire converges on this one tunnel. Camera pulls back, and it's a beautiful scene. It's a great sci-fi epic action sequence. Thousands of sentinels are coming through the hole, and they're dropping like flies where the guns are hitting them. But of course, they're getting through as well. The sheer amount of movement, I mean, the CGI of the Sentinels is pretty. I mean, just the processing power alone to bring this stuff to life. There are thousands of Sentinels, and each Sentinel is like a little squid. The sheer amount of movement on the screen is just pretty crazy. The kind of funny visual back and forth is that the Sentinels look like the more organic, and the men in the metal APCs look like the more robotic of the battle. It's almost like the men or the robots fighting this, you know, infestation of squids, and yet, of course, it's just the opposite. So, neat little visual flip. Now, we're flipping back and forth to Z and Charles as they're looking to find these positions up above the city, and they take a couple of shots at a digger, and they wind up taking one down after a few moments. And it's really neat because it's tough to hit the diggers because the Sentinels are sort of flying around in defense, and when these rockets are fired, most of the time they just hit the circling Sentinels and miss the actual diggers. The two girls are tough, man. Chara is a really tough character. They're just there doing their job. It's a really cool scene. Take one of these diggers down, and very well edited. I'm very clear on what's happening and what needs to get done and seeing it get done. And that's very satisfying for me as a viewer. So then back to the dock, we see three APUs back-to-back, very similar to Morpheus Trinity and Seraph when they went into the Merovingians. So a little visual echo. Things are getting dicey in the dock. Guys are getting picked off. There's just too many Sentinels. We witness a reload sequence. A guy runs out of the garage, and there's a little camera by the wheel. It brings us really right down to ground level, and we watch how these things are reloaded. It's great. Again, it brings the battle back to kind of some sort of semblance of reality. We're also flipping back and forth to the Logos, which is kind of, as I call it, Star Wars-ing its way back home. It's cool. The editing and what's happening is a little less, you really understand a little less what's going on, except there's 1,000 Sentinels attacking, and they're doing their best to sort of fight them off. So when you have an overwhelming enemy like this, sometimes it's really hard to gauge the progress of the battle. A lot of times in large-scale battles or action sequences of any time, they go on for long, and you as a viewer can't really tell whether they're having any effect. Sometimes it's difficult. And I guess the point, though, here is that they're not having much of an effect. They're up against an overwhelming force, and they'll do the best that they can. But in the end, you know, there's very little chance that they can succeed against wave of wave and wave of these things. What does, to me, save this battle is a second task emerges. They detect that the hammer is on their way back. We see that a Sentinel has ripped off the aerial, so they can't communicate with it. They realize they have to get the dock open, but some controls have been damaged, and it has to be done manually. So Mifune's APU is the closest. They task him to get to the door to open it up, but he is in this terrific battle against tons and tons of Sentinels, like it's his last stand, and he loses. At the time he loses, the kid had just reloaded him. And so when he's down, the kid runs up to Mifune, and Mifune says, "You got to get that door open." So the kid pulls him out, and he gets in his APU, and he's moving towards the dock. He's really, really close to shooting the counterweight when he's taken down by some Sentinels. But then we see that Z has heard Chara gets killed, actually, in one of the battles, which is tough. It's kind of a good death scene. We come to like her very quickly. It kind of sucks that she gets killed. But Z hears over the radio that the hammer's coming. She knows that Link is on it, that the door has to be opened. So she runs towards the dock. When the kid goes down, and we think, he's had it, she runs in with weapons, and she takes down all the Sentinels. In a Han Solo moment, tells the kid, "All right, kid, take the dock down." And then there's a really ill, cheesy line where you focus in on the kid as he zeroes the guns of the APU on the counterweight, and you focus in, and it says, "Neo, I believe." And he shoots the counterweight and the doors start to open. It's what it is. The hammer smashes through the partially open door. It triggers the EMP pulse. For the moment, the dock is saved. All the Sentinels are destroyed because of the wave. The entrance of the Logos is really spectacular. The door hasn't been completely opened when it comes through. It is amazing when it comes through, and it's just kind of slow-mo. And again, after the sequence, it's all about, you know, how Niobe can drive. You know, Morpheus is a supporting player now. Like, "Damn, woman, you can drive," or "That was some great driving." He's a commentator now. And now we're back to Neo and Trinity as they're taking the Logos up towards the surface. From Neo's point of view, we realize now that he can see the machines. We're taken through the fields where human beings are grown, which we saw briefly in the first Matrix. This time they flow through them, and Neo has a line, "I can feel them." So he's connected to the world in a whole different way. It's a great scene, a spectacular scene of the growing fields. And a little aside to this new talent of Neo's, it reminded me of sci-fi readers remember Dune Messiah, the sort of the slim second volume of the Dune saga. And in Dune Messiah, Atreides, who's been reduced to some crazy prophet from the sands, he's blinded by a nuclear device which is set off on planet of Dune. But he can still see because his vision of what is to come is so precise with what is occurring that it's as if he doesn't need eyes. He's seeing the world's vision through his head. It's a really, really wild concept. And it just reminded me of this, that even though Neo's blind, you know, that he is able to see. It's not the same concept, but it's similar, that he is able to see exactly what he needs to see to kind of do what he needs to do. I think it's cool. Brief cut back to Zion. We realize that the Sentinels have activated what was a downed digger above, and so now the city walls are going to be breached. Basically, in a couple of hours, the Sentinels will be able to get into Zion itself. They've blocked the dock. The humans have set off explosives and blocked the dock, but the diggers are going to tunnel right into the city itself now. So again, another clock is set. So now Neo and Trinity are approaching the Machine City. This is a sci-fi wet dream, man, because the Machine City's defenses come to life, and it is spectacular. The scale of this stuff is spectacular. All these machines kind of come to life. Thousands upon thousands of those bombs that we've come to know and Reloaded get launched towards the Logos. And Trinity's scared out of her mind, and Neo's like, just keep going. And as they encounter this wall of flying bombs, Neo puts up his hand, and similar to how he destroyed the Sentinels at the end of Reloaded, they start plowing through these bombs, and he's destroying like hundreds of hundreds of them, more and more and more. And then suddenly, a pack of Sentinels is attached to the hovercraft. They're starting to tear chunks of it off. Then we see that Neo becoming overwhelmed. There's just too many flying bombs, and even with his powers, he can't handle all of them. So they wind up going up over the bombs. And in one of the most beautiful moments in this whole bloody trilogy, you see the Logos breach. Basically, when you're outside, this whole all three movies, you know, when you're not in the Matrix, it's dingy, it's dark, it's dank, you're underground, it's grays and browns and black and bleh. For one moment, they breach the cloud cover that covers the world, we've been told, and we see this beautiful, beautiful vista of the sun shining and the tops of clouds. It is such a beautiful scene, and the ship basically crests it, and you get Trinity's reaction where she simply says, "Beautiful." Moments later, as the ship noses over and heads back down, it's gone. But it is a striking moment. As we'll see very soon, Trinity's last beautiful gasp, that she was able to get that far to see so much. The ship noses over. They wind up crashing into the Machine City. Neo basically wakes up and he's calling for Trinity, and he realizes something is wrong. And then the camera backs away, and we realize that during the crash, half a dozen of these metal lances have entered Trinity's body, and basically she's done for. So this is Trinity's death scene. The first, I would say, minute of it is okay. It's done very tenderly. These are some characters that have been through hell together. What starts as a very tender moment between two characters just continues on and on until I feel well after the emotional point has been rammed home or taken home. I feel like silence or cutting away would have made it that much more tragic rather than a continued "I love you." "No, I love you. You, this is how I love you. Well, this is how I love you." And it falls flat. And after such a beautiful scene of her seeing the sun and the sky, I felt that it was squandered with this death scene. And another little pet peeve, somehow, you know, the ship now is in the Machine City. Nobody's attacking. There's no sentinels. There's no bombs. They've basically been given a free pass. You know, logically, I don't really understand why, but it seems like they're free to kind of explore. We cut back to Zion, and we watch as the last digger breaches Zion. They all start to retreat, I guess, into the last fortified part of the city, which they call the temple. Pretty much, it's done. You know, they have no more APUs. They don't have any more defenses. Now that the Sentinels are in Zion itself, it's curtains, as they used to say. We see Z and Link look at each other, like preparing for the end. Now we're back to the Machine City. Neo is walking through a corridor, and it's beautiful. From his point of view, the whole city is made of light. we see from our normal viewer's point of view as well, what a beautiful cityscape it is. Again, dark and dank, but stretching out in all ways. It's a beautiful city. Neo reaches a precipice somewhere. All of a sudden, this huge, giant, spiked ball rises up. And the camera is behind Neo, and we see this giant spiked ball come up and float directly in front of him. I mean, the thing's huge, maybe like 100 feet wide. Very Wizard of Oz, no question about it. From Neo's perspective, it is an incredible locus of light. So I think as a viewer, we're meant to believe that this is the kind of sort of the center of the machine intelligence, the machine god or leader, however, as a viewer, you'd like to perceive this. It's fucking really cool. What happens is thousands of little machines get spewed out of the front of this thing, and they form like this kind of sort of this fluid area where the machine can make a face. And so in a sense, you have this very childlike face, which is continually morphing. And then this deep, incredible voice, which Highlander fans, it's Clancy Brown, ladies and gentlemen. Much modulated and affected, but you can kind of tell it's still Clancy. It's a wonderful scene. I mean, it's one of these scenes when you make it to the end of this movie where these guys still have it in them to pull these scenes out of the air, and you're just like, where the hell did this scene come from? You know, and it's uncanny and wonderful, and you're in it. There's a brief dialogue between the machine leader and Neo. They both talk about Smith. Basically, Neo tells the machine, you know, you can't defeat him. You're in as much danger as we are. I can stop it. And the machine tells him, what's your price? And Neo says, peace. And he says, what if you should fail? I won't. So then all these thousands of little machines kind of come out of the woodwork and surround Neo, and they sort of make this little platform for him, and he jacks into the Matrix. And just before that, you cut back to Zion, and just as the Sentinels are about to begin the last massacre, they hold. And Morpheus walks out, and Locke is like, Morpheus, what are you doing? Every word out of Locke's mouth in both of these movies is awful. But it's a great scene because the whole Sentinel army pauses, backs off, and goes into like this holding pattern. Morpheus looks up at us. He's like, Neo fights for us. And now we're at our final stand, Smith versus Neo. Neo enters the Matrix. He's walking down this long street that is completely ringed by Smiths on both sides. Smiths in all the windows of the buildings, ringing the street. It's pouring down rain. It's a really cool looking scene. And then one Smith detaches itself from the throng, basically says, I already know how this is going to end, which is why most of me is going to sit this one out. I guess you had to give the audience some kind of a softball of why they don't all just swarm Neo and kill him, why it has to be just one of them, but it's a movie, right? Hugo Weaving basically owns this movie, has this great line, do you like what I've done with the place? Neo is like, it ends tonight. They start to run towards each other. It's really big and bombastic. This chorale-type music, Carmina Burana, starts up, and it's just so overdriven. It's really, this fight scene overall, you know, the music, it really left the first film so far behind. And you're into, like, superheroes and gods, and obviously that's what they want, but I never got comfortable in the skin of this film as a sci-fi epic. So they have their first series of moves. After all the fighting and all these movies, I didn't give a crap. They reached the end of the first encounter. They're both thrown apart, and then they fly back towards each other, and the impact creates this shockwave, which clears all the water out of the surrounding area. And the camera pulls back from above, and it's like this bubble of air through the rain. It's fucking cool. Then the camera angle shifts, so you're inside the bubble, and when the bubble finally expands, all the rain and the water come back. And it's sort of like, you know, a rain-clearing shockwave, if you will. It's a cool effect. But this fight, they're flying around. It's basically Superman fighting Superman. They're flying around. Karate moves done in midair. I mean, I think literally they don't have any weight behind them, but it's something about the two of them fighting in midair that just seems, you're just out, you know. It's become very, very cartoonish. None of the blows make any sense. You just get a sense that, you know, they needed a climactic battle between him and Smith, and now that they're both almost like gods in the Matrix, how do the gods fight? This is how gods fight. It's almost too big and too bombastic. I don't know where to put myself as a viewer in this thing, except in my popcorn. So the final penultimate moment, Smith grabs Neo and flies down into the ground and creates this huge crater, and Neo's like really taken down. There's a nice shot of Smith standing over Neo, Neo on his back. And then Neo's getting up, and Smith goes into a bit of a monologue. Why do you get up? Why bother trying? What is it? It's kind of neat because he's genuinely baffled at what Neo is fighting for. He doesn't understand Neo in that moment. Are you fighting for love? Are you fighting for... And all the things he brings up that Neo's fighting for, you know, he's like, love is ridiculous. All these notions of honor and loyalty and all that stuff. They're all things that the human mind simply creates in order to, you know, hide from the fact that existence is pointless and futile. And it's a great speech by Smith. And Neo simply gets up and answers, I fight because I choose to. They go into the final endgame. He knocks Smith down for a moment, but of course Smith finally comes back and takes Neo down for good. And in one of these last moments is a cool bullet time motion where Neo and Smith are both swinging towards each other, and the bullet time is so slow that the raindrops look like they're fighting amidst icicles, and you watch the fists sort of break the raindrops when it finally impacts into Smith's face. And his face is sort of like goes all fluidy and liquidy. It's our last cool bullet time shot of them fighting each other. So now it's over. Neo's down. Smith walks close and he's like, I've foreseen this moment. I'm supposed to say something. And all of a sudden he says, everything that has a beginning has an end, Neo. And the fact that Smith is calling Anderson Neo clues us into it sounds very much like the Oracle is somewhere in there. Neo's eyes open, and we gather from the message he's just gotten that he now comprehends how this has got to end. And he gets up, and Smith looks at him, and he's kind of freaked out. He says, you're right, Smith. Actually, you are always right. It is inevitable. Smith backs up, but then he kind of shakes it off. He does his copying trick, and he copies himself. Neo is now copied and is a Smith. Then we cut back, and we see Neo in the Machine City. The Machine Leader now does something to Neo, and you can very clearly see it as we're looking at sort of the light schematic. Something is coming from the machine through Neo. The Smith that was copied from Neo slowly breaks apart. Basically, light emitting from it shatters it. Light emits from all of the Smiths, and basically all the Smiths in the Matrix are destroyed. Really cool sequence. They're all bunched together, and you see the light pop out of their glasses first. You know, obviously, we think about in the film that there's some kind of virus was designed by the machine through Neo's body to kill them, but it took Neo's consciousness death to do it. And all of the Smiths are destroyed via Neo. And it's a great scene. The Neo becomes the Trojan horse, where Smith is vulnerable. They are both destroyed, saving the Matrix. The Matrix is cleansed completely. So I want to digress a little bit about the meaning of the ending of this film, or what I took to be the meaning of it. When Neo kills Smith, seemingly, in the first Matrix, he creates an opposite of himself, a negative. Smith, as the negative of Neo, truly is a virus. He truly can see nothing but himself. He wants nothing but more. And his ultimate reality, what he wants, is a vast sea of himself. In a sense, Smith is the ego run rampant. Right? He is the ego given complete full reign. The ego trapped in its own reflection, which can only desire more of itself, more adherence to itself, more aspects of itself, more and more and more, and incredibly damaging, basically corrupting everything in its path, and can only see itself through its own self. So it must put itself upon everyone. If I look at you, you know, as a metaphor for the real world, if I'm all wrapped up in my ego and I'm an incredible narcissist and I'm just kind of stuck in my own head, everything that happens in the world, I perceive as having something to do with me. Everything is connected. Everything is personal. I take everything as an affront. You know, I believe that my way is the way that things should run. I brook no dissent. You know, it's sort of like a spiritual dictatorship of one's own psyche. I think it is brilliant that the answer to this is the destruction of both sides of that. You know, you have Neo's side, again, is the opposite. He's very selfless. He's basically doing everything that he's doing to save others. It is a complete opposite of Smith. He is the good to Smith's bad. But in a sense, the true way forward is the annihilation of both sides of this, and maybe the encapsulating of both sides into something even greater. The Oracle realizes that she says what she has to say. Neo, I think, understands that, like, this whole dialectic of good and bad needs to be annihilated, which means Smith has to be taken down. But it's not, Neo is not beating Smith. He cannot beat Smith because Smith is a part of him as much as Neo is a part of Smith. What's taken down is the whole cycle of good and evil. You know, that whole cycle is taken down and annihilated, and it's subsumed or transformed into something even greater. And I think it's a really great metaphor that it can't be done. In a sense, a power from outside of both of them must come in to the whole situation and take care of business, you know? So, in a sense, Neo realizes the machine leader is sort of the godlike presence here, and through him, this machine is able to end this dialectic between the two characters and annihilate them completely, which brings about balance to the whole Matrix. It's sort of the two extreme sides of man have unbalanced the whole thing, and both of them have to go away. Anyway, back to the finale of the movie. There's a great dirge that's played, sort of funeral dirge, as the machine takes up Neo's body. We don't know where it's going. You know, this being Hollywood, you never know where it's going. We cut back into the Matrix, and we see that the last Smith that was fighting Neo, now that all the Smiths have been destroyed, was actually the copy he made of the Oracle. And now we see the Oracle revealed. So she's alive. We see Sati is alive. Basically, even though Smith copied himself over all of the people in the Matrix, once his consciousness was destroyed, he actually had not killed anyone, and these programs were able to kind of reemerge, kind of reconstitute into themselves again. So Sati is alive, Oracle is alive, and we see Seraph is also alive. It's a great scene. We cut back to Zion, and the Sentinels are leaving. Humans realize that, you know, Neo did something. They don't know what. And it's a testament to movie magic that once they're screaming that the war is over, you get goosebumps. You can't help it. That this huge war that has plagued them for lifetimes, for now, is over. It's a great moment. And we say goodbye. Morpheus sort of says the goodbye. Him and Niobe look at each other and they hug. And, you know, she quietly thanks Neo. The last shot is sort of Morpheus looking up. We're out of Zion, back into the Matrix. For the last bit of the film, we see the code is changing back to the way the Matrix was. The Oracle is sitting on a park bench, and the architect approaches her, very cynically asks, you know, how long do you think this peace will last? The Oracle says, as long as it has to. The Oracle says, you know, are you going to allow the people who want out of the Matrix to leave? And the architect says, of course, I will keep my word. What do you think I am, human? Possibly meaning, you can take 1,000 meanings from this exchange, that it'll be humans that break the truce in the future. The peace is not going to last. Who knows? But obviously, there will remain in the Matrix a certain amount of human beings to allow the machines to live. Speculation is rampant on what will come forward. There's been nothing after this in comics, or I think there was a video game or two about what came after. I don't know the plot to it. If you're interested, you could probably Wikipedia it. The news being bandied about is that our prequels are being considered. So there's this beautiful sunrise that Sati created. We wind up that she is, an artist of some repute. Sati asks the Oracle the question that we all want to know as viewers, you know, will we ever see Neo again? And the Oracle matter-of-factly says, oh, I suspect we shall someday. And with that, Revolutions ends. That's it for the Matrix trilogy. I'll do, you know, a bit of a thematic recap. I think overall, thematically, with all the criticisms that you've heard me make for Reloaded and Revolutions, I've watched these three films a lot. And I think for me personally, even though I have a lot of problems with the sequels in terms of the being standalone films of their own with plot and character, the themes are so interesting. They're so interesting for a sci-fi film to be playing with themes like this and to be subverting certain things that, at the end of the day, I think the trilogy does work. It does function as a really good piece of kinetic pop entertainment with things that you can walk out of the theater and really chew over. Like, underneath all of this, you know, if you just want to watch some chop sake and a lot of action sequences, you're good to go. It's plenty of that. If you want to walk out of the movie and talk about the nature of religion, nature of choice or love or causality, you know, they've got all these notions in this film, and I have to give them massive credit for trying to combine sort of high and low into something. And I think at the end of the day, it succeeds. I think largely the weight of these ideas, the weight of the visuals, they create an indelible set of visuals that say what you want about things in the films. The visuals are very consistent throughout all three movies. The Matrix is a very distinct film. You see a couple of frames of the Matrix on TV or here and there, you know it's The Matrix. You very quickly, this film's universe is very unique and it's very indelible. And I think that besides all the ideas that they introduced and the martial arts aspect of it, which I thought, in a sense, personally grew less over time, the execution, obviously, the first film I thought was a perfect little B sci-fi movie. Just a perfect film. I have very few problems with it. The sequels, as amazing thematically as they were, I thought had a lot of problems with bloat and cliche. And they were borrowing from a lot of other directors who had done similar things. And I think as standalone movies, they suffered. They really did suffer on their own. There were a lot of things that pushed me out of the film. But even at the end of Reloaded, the themes about the prophecy being a sham blew my head up. I was thinking about them for days. The nature of Neo and Trinity and that they both died at the end of Revolutions, you know, that there were necessary deaths, were amazing. The mishandling of Morpheus in the third film, I thought to myself, man, I would have loved to have seen Morpheus give his life for Neo to get him back from the Merovingian. And the prophet would have died as, you know, John the Baptist was beheaded before Jesus kind of came into his own. Me personally, it would have been really cool to have Morpheus die and give his life for Neo at the end of the day. It would have been cool, you know, because Morpheus was really mishandled in the third film. He didn't belong in it, I didn't think. But overall, this is a classic science fiction trilogy. I think these films are going to stand for quite a while. I certainly really enjoy watching them from time to time over and over again. I'm always blown away by the visuals and the themes, whatever issues I may have here and there with other things. So this ends the third of the Matrix podcasts. I had real fun making this one. We'll be back soon. This is Sci-Fi on Screen.